When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I've had a really complicated relationship with the word creative. Whether we're talking about being a creative person or being a creative as a noun, either way, I have had complicated feelings about it for myself. Hey, welcome back. This is Not For Everyone. I'm Jess, and this is a solo episode. It's Jess Thoughts. Caroline is off gallivanting on a secret vacation. Her boyfriend, Justin, took her on a secret vacation. I don't think she knew where they were going until like that day. And they're having a lovely time. So happy days to them. Happy anniversary, actually. I think it's their 1 year anniversary. So that's where she is. I'm here in the same spot. You'll always find me in the corner of my bedroom, cuddled up on an armchair. This is always where I record the pod. I know there's no video today. We don't do video for our solo episodes. So I'm just painting the scene for you. Painting myself like a French girl in your mind, a Lebanese girl in your mind. Anyway, hi. I'm happy to be here. I've been wanting to do a Jess Thoughts for a little while because I have some things on my mind and things to share. But before I get into the thick of it with two C's, let me just take a step back and let you know where I've been emotionally and mentally the last few weeks. I wrote down in my notes, like, creativity and exhaustion. That's where I've been. Somewhere on that spectrum or at that Venn diagram, I had this really creative, like, two-week span, maybe at the end of March, beginning of April, and it was, like, so dope. It was so dope. People were noticing. People I work with, because I work in marketing, I do get to do some creative stuff, and people at work were like, you're on a roll, like you're having such creative ideas lately. Amazing to get that feedback. For the podcast, I feel like I did some funny promotional clips on Instagram and YouTube shorts. If you follow us there, you'll see. I kind of like just felt really inspired to do some new and different stuff and step out of my comfort zone creatively and like make things that are just more fun and playful and like allow me to express something new. And it was such a good feeling. And I had this realization where I was like, I feel like I've been sleeping for the past 6 months, at least. Like I've been dormant. Jess has been in hibernation. I know people say that all the time when it's winter, especially people like me who live in Chicago in really cold places. It's like hibernation season, S-Z-N, for whatever reason. We're spelling it that way. I am serious when I say I was in like the utmost hibernation. I did very little, I feel like, over the last 6 months. I saw a few of my core people, and usually that was in my home or their home. And I don't know. I just was like dormant. And even though I kind of felt bored and I kind of felt like lazy and I was kind of being hard on myself about like, why are you just at home, not getting out there, not doing like exciting new things, not meeting new people, not trying new restaurants and taking in the great city that you live in. Like I was really hard on myself about it. And then I had these 2 weeks in April, finally, where I was like, oh shit, this is what the break was for. Like I was on a creative roll after months and months of being dormant. and just kind of like doing my routine things, like at work, just doing what is expected of me, at podcast, doing what's expected of me. And what's expected of me is not chump change. Like, that takes energy. I have many commitments that I try to do my best in. And so, like, that's not nothing. But I felt like I'm just every week doing the same thing over and over and not feeling like there's been a big breakthrough recently. And I kind of get obsessed with like these personal breakthrough moments and personal growth and always being better and expressing myself in new ways and blah, blah, blah. I put pressure on myself in that way, put pressure on myself in a lot of ways, but it probably all boils down to that. And yeah, then the like, what's the saying? The smoke cleared. I wanted to say the trees cleared. Like, I came to a clearing in the woods. That's a thing, right? I feel like I came to a clearing in the woods. I don't think it was the smoke. I think it was a clearing in the woods. And felt really creative at the end of all of that rest. And it was really gratifying because it's what I'd been wanting from myself. And I finally was delivering consistently in many areas of my life. And guess what? I'm recording this on April 21st. This episode comes out April 25th. It'll be long gone by then. I mean, today I sit here and I tell you that creativity is already on its way out. I had it for 2 weeks after 6 months of rest, and it's already on its way out. I don't think that I grabbed the bull by the horns fast enough in those 2 weeks. I really don't. I think I should have done more. If I knew it was only going to be 2 weeks that I got of like massively creative, out of the box thinking, I would have done so much more with it. I was just kind of vibing. I didn't even realize I was in it until week two. And then it was gone like that. And I'm tired again. I don't know what this cycle is, this creative exhaustion spectrum and cycle. Like, it's a up and down, like a sine curve. Wow, that was the most mathematical thing I've said in 15 years. Sine curve. So scientific of me. Well, let me look that up and make sure I'm describing the right thing. Because there's sine, there's cosine, there's tangent. And I feel like I'm talking about the sine curve. Yep, that's it, baby. Sine wave, I guess, is what they call it. Okay. This creative exhaustion sine wave that I'm riding. Here's the thing. I actually don't know if it's a sine wave because it looks like a sine wave is always continuously like the same height. And I don't think that's how it is. I think it's like the angle or something that the peak of creativity happens at is like a very tight angle, like a very tight curve, bell curve at the top. And then it's like a wide bottom of the curve because that exhaustion period is like much longer than the creative period. Okay, you get what I'm saying. I really wanted to make this science. It's frustrating. Because during those 2 weeks where I felt really creative, I was like, I had not only had things I was executing in the moment that I was like super psyched about and proud of, and like finally my brain's working in this new way and I'm thrilled, but I also had all these ideas for the future. I was like, okay, now that I'm feeling creative, next week I'll do this, and the week after I'll do this. I'll start doing vlogs and I'll start posting multiple clips a week on Instagram, and I'll start, who knows, the opportunities are endless. I also do like video editing and, you know, that sort of stuff, not only on the podcast side, but at work. And I had all these brilliant ideas for the videos I'm making at work, and like, it was gonna be sick. And then the 2 week period ended, and I'm now stuck with all of the ideas I had when I was feeling creative, and I'm not feeling that way anymore. Maybe it's less about creativity and it's more about motivation. There's a difference between feeling creative and feeling motivated to execute on the creativity. I'll have to factor this into the scientific theory. I'm not ready to speak on that quite yet. It's something about my motivation. Like, I had a peak of motivation and a creative spike at the same time. And now, I don't know, maybe the creativity's not gone. Maybe it's just the motivation. I don't know how people stay motivated for long stretches of time. I'm such a person that works in spurts, even not even like a spurt of 2 weeks when I'm feeling really good. I mean, like, within a day, a spurt of like 3 hours where I do everything I've needed to do for the whole week. And it's like, it's insane. If you were to watch my computer screen in that 3 hour span, it is insane how much is happening at once and how many different, you know, windows I'm bopping between and how many people I'm in conversation with and all of the documents that are open that I'm like, we're done. Now I can go on with my life. Like, that's always the way I've been. I work in spurts. I studied in spurts growing up, and in college, it was like late night cramming is another word for it, but it was really focused spurts, I think, if I'm generous to myself. I just want to work for the least amount of time, but get the most impact out of that work so that my life can be sick. Isn't that what we all want? So yeah, I've always been this spurts person, and my creative spurt came and went faster than I was prepared for. And now I'm sitting here like, I got Jess thoughts that I was inspired to record. I have a vlog that I'm trying to make for you guys. I don't know. Okay, that's how I've been feeling. I don't have any, like, there's nothing more to say about it. I don't have solutions. I don't think it's going to change. Like, I just don't even, there's nothing more to say about it. It is what it is, and you got to ride those waves when they come to you, I guess. I don't know if someone's figured something else out. Don't even tell me, because I really like resting. Here's the thing. And I know this is what Caroline would say if she was here. I wouldn't be able to have those spurts of energy and spurts of creativity and spurts of hard work if I didn't give myself rest. That is true. I know. That's why I give myself the rest. I don't deprive myself of it. I really don't. But it's so frustrating to me how much more rest I need comparatively. Like, I've been seeing a lot of stuff on Instagram recently about how women need more sleep than men, which, like, doesn't surprise me based on men that I've known and partners that I've seen how they sleep and whatever. But it's like the standard 7 to 8 hours was based on a man's REM cycle, and women actually need closer to 9 hours, which I've always said I need 9 hours of sleep. Like, that's my baseline. What's that have to do with anything? I don't know. I need a lot of sleep. I'm a sleepy girl. I'm a sleepy baby. I don't know. Does anyone else feel this tired? Here's the thing too. Like, I'm tired and I have a lot going on. You could say that. You could tell me, Jess, you have a lot going on, and that's the reason why you're especially tired and needing more rest than you've ever needed before. Okay. Thank you. I agree. But I'm happy about all the things I have going on. Like, I've been burnt out before in my career when I took my year off a couple years ago. That was a reaction to burnout. I was burnt out from 8 to 10 years, something in that window. I don't remember how long it was. It's all a blur of working in the corporate world and just like grinding for the next promotion every single fucking time and having that be so much of my life. I was burnt out and I took a break and I came back and I eased into things. But now it's been 2 years since I came back to working. The podcast has started in this time. I've taken on other commitments and I love all of my commitments because now I have an understanding of like what the mix of things is to fulfill the life that I want and to fulfill me personally and creatively and all of that. And I have the mix. So there's not even one thing that I'm like, that has to go. That's draining me. It's like, it all is kind of fun. But there's just not enough time in the day and there's just not enough energy to go around. and I cannot get enough rest. I guess I'm just saying all of this to normalize it, maybe for myself, but maybe for you too. Like, if you're in a period where you're building, that's what I feel like I'm in. I'm building, like with the podcast, we're building. And that requires a lot of focused energy and then a lot of times of nothingness. And maybe that's just how it works. So if you're in one of those two, I feel you. On this topic of creativity, I actually asked you recently on Instagram at not the number four everyone pod, baby. I asked you guys how many of you consider yourselves a creative. Specifically used that wording, which some people debated. Did that rhyme? Creative debated, kind of. Slant rhyme? Is that what that's called? Anyway, 74% of you said yes, you consider yourselves a creative, and 26% said no. That was interesting. It was kind of a thing that I had a hunch about, that we have a lot of creatives in our audience. And I know we have a much bigger audience than just the people that follow us on Instagram. So hopefully the rest of you don't feel misrepresented by that data. But I'm going to talk about both sides of it, okay? So then I asked people who feel that they are creatives, what does that mean to you? And it was so fascinating to me the way that people answered. Let me find a good example. Somebody said, having fun with life. Yeah, hell yeah, brother. Didn't know that makes you a creative, but I won't take it from you. If that's your definition of being a creative, you let yourself be free and be playful and just like be what you are and not doubt it. It's so much better than me. Good for you. Yeah, somebody else said freedom. Being a creative is freedom. Love it. Freaking love it. Some people made it a little more specific. You know, I interpreted it as for my career. For example, making money by painting, sewing, designing, etc. So some people got more literal with it. But some people were way more broad. Not being afraid of trying the quote unquote stupid ideas. Love that definition. Being able to create something special with my hands. Love that. But, you know, that would disqualify like podcasters or YouTubers as an example. If it really needs to be with your hands, like we be at a computer, I'm holding a microphone in my hand, but I don't know if that's what you meant. So I found this data as a scientist, very interesting. And I loved how broad it was, the way that people who do consider themselves creatives define that. Because there were people that like, maybe to me, I wouldn't have called a creative, who still raised their hand and said, no, I am. Because I live my life with this freedom and with this openness, and that's all it takes. And that really taught me something. So I loved it. Then I asked, if you don't consider yourself a creative, why not? Those answers were just as fascinating. This person wrote, from one scientist to another, are scientists creatives? Good question. Because I think scientists, like ourselves, need to be creative. They have to think about, you know, problem solving in creative ways, think outside the box and test hypotheses. Like, science is creative. Do they count as creatives, like the noun that we all use these days? You know, I don't know how you define that. Some people define that as like people who their life's work and their occupation is creative. And some people define it more broadly. So it depends on your definition. I love, are scientists creative? I love that. I think they are creative. Are they creatives? Up to your definition. Somebody else said the reason they don't consider themselves a creative is because they don't really make anything. To me, a core part of being a creative is the create part. So then my next question would be like, what do you have to create? Does it have to be something you can physically hold? Does it have to be something that can be observed or consumed by other people? Or can you create ideas within your own brain? Can you create a bedroom that is cozy and comfortable to you? Can you create an outfit? Or you know, just something in your day-to-day life, a really yummy lunch, not as a chef, just as yourself. And like, can that count? We're all creating all the time. I guess it gets to that whole thing of like, art is in the eye of the beholder. Like, who gets to decide what's art and what's not? Who gets to decide what's creation? Does art and being artistic and being artsy equal being creative? Not necessarily. I've had a really complicated relationship with the word creative. Whether we're talking about being a creative person or being a creative as a noun, either way, I have had complicated feelings about it for myself. Growing up, I never thought I was creative. I was good in school, and that felt anti-creative. Like, I did well on tests and studying and something that was really prioritized in my household and my family was like education and doing well in school. And so that was my focus growing up. I was a little nerd and I didn't think that I could be creative by doing that. I sang my whole life. I was in choir and did musicals at school, and that didn't even feel creative because I was performing someone else's music or art or whatever. And I was just like the vehicle, and I just sang, and it was a hobby. And I didn't feel that that was creative either. It was just like an extracurricular activity, maybe a talent, but not necessarily me being creative. And this pervades my life. Like, I went on to go to college, join an a cappella group. The singing continued. I would compose some of our arrangements for the a cappella group. I was actually, this is a funny thing to mention, I was webmaster for 2 years within the a cappella group, which basically meant that I like ran our online presence, really our website. But then I was the one who like put us on Facebook and put us on Instagram and kind of like revived our YouTube channel and things like that. And that was all under the title of webmaster. And my friends would always and still will joke and refer to me as webmaster, especially now that I do podcasting and like do the social media clips and stuff for the podcast. And I'm in marketing, like for a digital company, like it's very webmaster. So that has continued in my life. And I never thought of that as creative either. I felt it was technical. Maybe the term webmaster didn't help. I never gave myself credit for being creative. I would make these like hilarious videos of my a cappella group for our concerts. And they would be like these little comedy bit videos. And I taught myself how to like mix music so that we could record one of our songs. And I spent an entire semester, instead of focusing on my classes, because now I'm in college and my parents don't know, I was just like in the recording studio late every night that I could be working on mixing a song for my a cappella group, and brought in all the girls to sing their part. And I laid them on top of each other and messed with the dynamics. And it's on YouTube. You can find it. And I still didn't consider myself a creative. I don't know why. I'm not painting. Like, what would count? And it's taken me until now, 32 years old, to give myself credit that I am both a creative person and a creative, because I, at least now, am in a field where I'm creating content. I'm creating something that can help people, creating something that's an expression of myself. And I would probably have given that to 20-year-old Jess in the recording studio too. So it's really interesting for me to ask other people their relationship with these words, because I can look back on a younger version of myself who was always creative and who has become a creative. And I still have a corporate job. You know, I still do the traditional things, but that doesn't take that away from me. And I've never been one to create like a little pot that I molded with my hands on the clay wheel, pottery wheel, and gave it to my mama. Like, I've never been like that. It doesn't mean I'm not creative. So I don't know if this meant anything, if I said anything just now. Also, my texts are blowing up. Abby and Caroline are texting about skincare, which I want to take part in. Okay. Moving on. On this similar topic of creativity, I got a what to do that said what to do when you want to create content online but are worried about your employer seeing. You're asking the right gal. I probably should worry more about my employer seeing things that I say on the podcast or the Instagram reel I recently made that was specifically about my butt. Like, I guess that should be a concern. I don't know. I think because I put it out there when I applied for this job that I'm a podcaster and that I've done comedy, like, I just put it all out on the table when I applied because I had just taken a year off and, you know, we were all still in the thick of the pandemic and there was so much emphasis on people leaving their jobs to look for something more fulfilling and people starting their side hustles. And like, it was just really normalized at the time. And I would say it's remained normalized. But so I was just of the mindset that like the employer that is going to be right for me in this next phase of my life, where I want to still have these creative pursuits on the side, is the employer that knows that I do this and knows that that's part of what they're signing on for and actually sees it as an asset. Like, it should be, especially in my role in marketing, it should be an asset to my employer that I know how to build an online business. I know how to do video and audio editing. I know how to, you know, craft a story in a way that's going to be engaging for people. Like, the skills that I have that I'm using in my content creation job are also skills that I have positioned to my employer as assets to them. And so maybe you can try to do something like that. I know that that's not realistic everywhere, but I think there's more and more companies that are getting comfortable with the idea that many of their employees are going to have side hustles, and especially companies that are in newer fields. Like, I work in digital health, in tech. And so I think that field is especially open to it because it's a lot of young people. They have an awareness that like the internet is a thing and it's a place that people can make money and where people can express themselves creatively. And like, I think that that is becoming more and more normalized. So I would almost get ahead of it. It's the similar advice that I gave to Caroline about being a YouTuber and feeling weird about that on the dating apps. And I was like, is it on your profile? And she said it wasn't. And once she put it on her profile, it was like an unlock for her because she had been so worried about going on a couple dates and finally revealing to someone that she was a YouTuber and what that would say about her, as opposed to just putting it out there from the start. And anybody who wasn't interested in that could self-eliminate. I almost think about it the same way. Like, I recognize this is not possible for every career and every type of job, but if you have the ability to kind of lead with it and show why it makes you different and why it makes you a good hire, I think that can go a long way. Sounds though like this person is really talking more about like they're at a job currently. They're not necessarily looking to get a new job. They're like solidly with this employer and they want to start creating content online. Maybe it depends a bit on like what kind of content you want to create. If it's going to be something super salacious or graphic or with a ton of cursing or a ton of sexual references or whatever, I would maybe be careful about it. And it's also like, where's the content going? There's some weird safety in a podcast where like somebody has to go and pull up my podcast and listen to 70 episodes to find little bits and pieces of things that I say that may be unattractive to my employer. it's not an Instagram reel that could just pop up on anyone's feed and it's a minute long and you get it right then and there. So I think maybe some of it depends on like the type of content you want to do and where you want to put it. I can't really speak to how that feels. Like, I do see these corporate influencers who are making fun of their corporate jobs on Instagram and they still have their corporate jobs. And I don't really know how they got the confidence, the wherewithal, the chutzpah to do that. But I mean, you see that it's working for them. Corporate Natalie, I think is her name, is a good example. I'm pretty sure she still works at Deloitte, like big consulting firm, and puts out Instagram reels and TikToks and all that on, in her side hustle, content creating, that directly make fun of corporate nuances. So there's a way to do it. And that's a major kind of buttoned up company. I think as long as you're not like slandering your employer, I'm very careful not to speak directly about my company to make it clear that like my opinions are my own. Also to not shit talk like people I work with and not complain about, you know, a manager or a coworker or whatever. If I'm doing that, I'm masking it so that you can't quite tell who I'm talking about. And I'm really trying not to do that, honestly, most of the time. So I don't know. Those are the obvious things of like, don't go and blow your company's spot and shit talk all your coworkers. But I don't know. I just think the world's changing. And I think that this is less of a thing to be concerned about for the most part. And I do think, okay, what's the worst that happens? They fire you. I know that's not great. That is a pretty bad thing to happen. I understand. But you will, I bet, be able to find a different employer who's okay with it. And I actually don't think it would come down to them firing you. I think that they would do a lot of other things first. You would have to put something out there on the internet that's so egregious for them to just straight up fire you on the spot. So I don't know. I say just start. It takes a really long time to make any headway on the internet too. And, you know, content creation like takes a long time for people to start noticing your stuff. So I feel like you can start. And if it starts to pick up, or if coworkers start to notice, or if you have some friends at work who you feel comfortable sharing it with, I think don't make it a secret, but also don't make it a problem, you know, like it should be somewhere. It should just be a thing that you do on the side, and it doesn't really have any bearing on work. And if you can maintain that, because it doesn't threaten like your company, doesn't threaten your coworkers, and you still show up to work and do your job and do it well, then like, what are they going to say? I mean, I don't make it a topic at work, really. It comes up occasionally if we're having kind of social chat, but I'm not talking about my podcast all the time at work. So that's what I mean by don't make it a problem. Like, it's not their problem. It doesn't have to do with them. So I treat it as a separate thing, but at the same time, it's not a secret, because if it was a secret, then I would feel like there's something for them to go find out about me and about my podcast. And it's like almost more, again, problematic. Like, there's a fine balance that I'm walking where it's known that I have a podcast at my work, but I don't make it anybody else's problem, and it doesn't change my performance. And if they wanted to find it, great, but they wouldn't find anything they should be worried about, you know? I know that this has a lot of caveats and that it can really depend on your employer, but just look at all these people creating content online that have day jobs, that have full-time jobs. It's so many people. I used to look at content creators and think like, oh, all of them are full-time, and think that that was my goal. And I do think it is my goal one day, but I've actually gotten a lot more comfortable with the idea that I may be doing the podcast and content creating in this way and holding down the fort on my full-time job in tandem for a long time. because it just provides me a good stability and it makes it so that my content creation is not my source of income. And I think that's a really healthy thing for me at the moment. And so I've gotten comfortable with the idea that like, I may just have a side hustle and have a day job for a long time. And I've also seen that a lot of the content creators that I see pop up online do the exact same thing. And it's really not uncommon that people are starting like online businesses while they have a 9-to-5. And so employers, I think, are getting more comfortable with that. And hopefully you're at an employer that can have that kind of like open-mindedness, forward thinking, is a little bit younger, where it really doesn't have to be that big of a deal. I don't know. People will ask me like, how do you feel so comfortable talking about this stuff when like your boss can see? It's like, I'm sorry. What's the worst thing I talk about on the podcast? Stuckness? Stuck fantasies and sex? Like, okay, so my boss finds out I have sex? Oh, I'm so sorry to my 30-something-year-old boss who also has sex because she has a bunch of kids. I'm so sorry. I'm saying this facetiously. If she's listening, she knows this isn't a big deal. That's the thing. Like, what's so bad about being on a podcast talking about sex? Am I going into graphic detail? No. But is sex a thing that exists and I'm talking about it like a person who talks to a friend over the weekend? Yes. And that is what, I mean, it's like your employer can't stop you from doing that. I don't know. It's just like, I don't think anything I put here is that big of a deal if my employer saw it. I try to speak on the podcast as though nobody's listening, as though nobody I know and nobody that has authority over me is listening, because I want to speak freely. But that being said, if they did listen, I don't think I would be like specifically concerned about anything. I think one of the reasons that I felt my creativity spike at the beginning of the month is because I had been in maybe 5 weeks already of EMDR, which is eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. It's a type of therapy, and I feel like healing contributes to creativity and has been helping me like sleep better and get better rest, which I was talking about earlier. It's a type of therapy that my therapist that I've been seeing for a long time recommended to me, because she felt like we've been doing talk therapy together for almost 10 years and I have all the insights. She said it's insights-based therapy that we've been doing, and you have all the insights. But if you're still feeling stuck in certain ways or still can't shake certain like deep-rooted, bodily-held anxieties, even though you know the insights to like correct them, but if you still can't shake that feeling, then there might be other resources available to you that we should try. And one of them was EMDR. So my talk therapist referred me to an EMDR therapist. I've been now seeing her for probably like 8 or 9 sessions. And I think I'm close to being quote unquote done. And it's a way to help people process their memories, whether they are big T traumatic memories, like something really undebatably egregious happened to you, or little T trauma memories, like before you were even able to cognitively hold memory, you were crying in your crib and your mom didn't pick you up fast enough one time. That can cause a traumatic response in some people. So no matter where you are on the like little T trauma to big T trauma spectrum, EMDR can be a helpful tool to help you integrate those traumatic memories so that they're just less easily triggered in your body. Like the speed with which I can get an anxious tummy ache from a very minor interaction with my parents that makes me feel like they're disappointed in me, like I've done something wrong. It can happen at the drop of a hat and they don't even know they're doing something or saying something that's triggering that. And I know that that's not their intention, but it is a response that I've formed and a pattern that's happened in my body over and over again. And continuing to just like talk myself down from it, understand the reasons why I'm feeling that way, all of the things I've explored in talk therapy, like that's gotten me to a certain point of healing, but there just, it just became clear that there's still more healing that I need to do because of how deeply that type of trigger is held in my body. So that's the reason I started EMDR in a nutshell. I'm not going to go too much into how EMDR works and what it is, you know, in practice. You can find that online. I would recommend watching the YouTube video of Prince Harry doing EMDR. If you just Google that, EMDR Prince Harry, you'll be able to find it and it'll show you exactly how it works. And, you know, potentially it could be a good option for you. So I would ask your therapist or your doctor about it. But remember that I'm not a professional, not a therapist, not a scientist, even though I joke that I am. This is just something that's been working for me. And I wanted to share a few of the things I've learned as they pertain to my relationship with my parents. I alluded to this earlier, but I definitely feel a lot of pressure to perform because of my parents or for my parents, to do well in school, to make good decisions that lead to, you know, what they deem as a successful life, whether that's education-wise, career-wise, choosing a partner, where I live, if I live close to them, like all of these decisions that you start to make as an adult when you're individuating, that's one word that I've learned from therapy. It can be really hard if you have a family that has a little bit of codependence in it, is very connected, and especially if you come from certain cultures. I've said this a million times, but my family's Lebanese. My parents are both born and raised in Lebanon, and they moved to the States in their 20s. And they came here for the American dream. You know, they came here to have a better life, to find success, to build for their children. And they've done that. And it's an amazing thing. I have a lot of pride in them. I feel very proud of them. And like where they came from to where they are now is an unbelievable success story. And so I feel whether it's directly from them or indirectly within myself, I feel a lot of pressure to uphold that and not disappoint them because they've sacrificed so much and they've done it all for me and my sister. And, that shows up in so many parts of my life. And even though I know from working through things in talk therapy that I am worthy of love and acceptance and worthy of my parents being proud of me just for being me, I'm a good person. I work hard. I try to be better all the time. You know, basic things that make me someone they should be proud of and that they are proud of. I still really latch on to moments when they are not as pleased with something I'm doing or a decision I made in my life. And I like can't move past it. I feel a lot of guilt and I feel a lot of turmoil of like, if they don't agree with this thing, then even if I feel good about it in myself, which first of all, it takes a really long time to get to a point where you know that you feel good about something independent of your parents' opinion of it when you have a relationship with your parents like the one that I have. But even if I finally get there to the point of like, I know what I'm doing is right for me, it still is held in my body, this feeling that I'm doing something wrong simply because I'm not doing what they would have chosen. And that takes me to the first term that I learned in EMDR, which is survival parenting. And if you, like me, have parents who kind of came from somewhere else to start a better life and have been through a lot of big T trauma compared to my little T trauma. You may have experienced survival parenting, which is this style of parenting that is very, we do one thing and we take one path because that is the path that guarantees success and safety. And it's the path that guarantees survival. Risks are scary. They have to be very calculated if taken. There's one way that we have tested and tried and we know it works, tried and true way of living your life. And that's what we want for you because we want you to survive in this scary, scary world that we have had to survive in. That's the mindset of survival parenting. And I can appreciate where it comes from. Totally. I have so much admiration for and pride in the survival that my parents have had to do and how they've come out on top. But I live in a different world and a different time, a different place than them. I don't live in a war-torn Lebanon like they did, for one. And I also have a lot more privilege because of the work that they've put in that they maybe didn't have from their parents and their upbringings. And so the context is different. And I have to remind myself a lot now that I have this new term, survival parenting, that the thing that my parents are often trying to steer me towards, the thing that they would have chosen for me. And so when I veer off course of that path that they've imagined for me, it's because the thing that they would have chosen is the safer thing, the survival choice. It doesn't make it bad. It doesn't make it wrong. I could have a good life by choosing that path, but it's not wrong. It's not inherently wrong of me to choose a different path. I'm just not operating in survival mode the way that they are. And that's what they wanted for me. They didn't want their kids to have to operate in survival mode, but it's what they're used to. And it can be really helpful for me to remind myself of that because it's so easy to trust this feeling in your body that is held from when you're a kid. That's like, my parents, I have to do what they say. They know what's best. They're protecting me. They're here to keep me safe. If they're telling me they're concerned about a decision I'm making, that must be a really scary, bad thing. It's very easy to trust that voice. But if I remind myself my parents are operating from a survival perspective, and that's not a perspective that I have to operate from, I'm privileged and blessed not to have to do that, it helps me come back down to earth and be like, what I'm doing is not bad. Like, there are millions of paths that a life can take, and none of them is inherently bad. You can have certain types of jobs and marry certain types of people and live certain types of places, and like, that's all fine and good, and plenty of people exist and have good lives doing many different things, different from what my parents have done for themselves, different from what they would choose for me. And all those things are valid and okay, and they're not dangerous, and they're not bad. My parents are just coming from a survival perspective. I do get a lot of questions in my DMs from people asking about kind of differentiating and individuating from your family and from your parents. Everything from I moved away and it's scary out here, you know, to I'm dating someone that my parents don't approve of, to I'm taking a risk in my career that my parents are in my head about. And I've wanted to talk about this for a while, but I struggle with it. So it's really hard to give advice when I'm currently in therapy to overcome this same battle. But hopefully some of these terms can get people a little bit closer to feeling better about it. And like I said, you know, the terms are only one thing. Having the knowledge is only one thing, but potentially you may want to look into different forms of therapy too, to get you a little further than just like the intellectualization of these topics. So anyway, survival parenting. That's one thing that I want my first generation girlies to remember. Another thing that's super relevant for folks whose parents come from other cultures is this idea of a high context versus low context culture. So you may ask me, like, Jess, why do you feel such a fear of abandonment from your parents? They've done nothing but love and support you. And to that I'll say, I'll dig deep and I'll eventually come out and say, well, sometimes the look on their face just is scathing to me. I feel like I'm disappointing them so much when I get a certain look on their face. And that's because that look holds volumes. It holds generational opinions of what is the right way to live your life and what is the wrong way. One word or phrase can hold multitudes when it comes from my parents because they come from a high context culture, which is a culture that communicates in ways that are implicit and rely heavily on context. Like Lebanese people can literally be like, tfit. Like that's a sound, TFF, tfit. And it means like, ew, but it means it in a very like cutting way. Like, oh, that is so beneath me, tfit. And there's a lot of other like little sounds or little phrases or facial expressions or hand gestures that mean so much. And so if I'm talking to a white American friend of mine about an interaction I recently had with my parents that left me anxious, and I'm saying it was just the look on their face or just you should have heard their tone. And a lot of times my friends, white American friends, nothing wrong with this, will be like, okay, so they're annoyed, like, whatever. Did you explain yourself and did they listen? Okay, what else are you going to do? And I'm like, you don't understand what this means. You don't understand how I'm going against generations of context on why the thing I'm in trouble for or the thing that my parents are mad at me about or the thing that I'm disappointing them about is like, it's more than just this one thing. It holds multitudes. America is a low context culture. A low context culture is where we explain everything here. We rely on spoken, written word to communicate meaning. We do way less assuming because people here are from all different types of backgrounds and we kind of have to like speak up about what we mean when we say things. It's a lot more direct. It's a lot more efficient. It's just like, hey, this is what I mean. This is how you made me feel. This is what I think about what you're doing. That's a low context culture. And in America, that's what we live in. But in other cultures, in immigrant families in America, there is so much high context that says it all. So I might know that my parents love me. And in America, in a low context culture, that might be enough because, okay, they said these words. They said they'll love me and support me no matter what. I accept. Thank you so much. But coming from a high context culture, it's like, but how did they say it? And what was the look on their face? I'm not saying this doesn't also happen in white American households, but there's just something about coming from a high context culture where I've become another key word I've learned from EMDR, hypervigilant. Hypervigilance is a state of heightened awareness around your surroundings and the way that people are acting and what they're saying. I'm monitoring all the time the vibe. That can do me really well. Like, I always know what the vibe is. I can read the room like no one else. Just at a social event, at a party, at work, I'm so good at reading the room. But the flip side of it is I am hyper aware of every tone shift, every tense moment, every word that's said, and I'm also hyper aware of the words I'm saying, while I'm hyper vigilant towards others, I'm also hyper vigilant about what's coming out of my mouth. And it just puts me on guard at all times, really, and especially in these dynamics with my family. And so between being a hyper vigilant person with survival parents from a high context culture, I'm set up for failure when it comes to individuating from childhood into adulthood and living a life that serves me regardless of the expectations of my parents. I am set up for failure. But now I have the terms and I'm working on how my body carries my little t trauma. And so I'm getting somewhere, I think. Did I do it? I talked and I talked. And now we're here. Thanks for listening. This has been Not For Everyone, a Jess Thoughts solo episode with me, your lover, Jess. Missing Caroline. I feel like she'd have so many additions on the creative topic and on the therapy topic, but those conversations are for another day. You can follow us on Instagram at @not4everyonepod. And you can also find us on YouTube at the same handle. I'm Jay-Z DeBakey on Instagram. Caroline is on YouTube, Caroline Winkler. I'll also maybe be on YouTube soon, vlogging. TBD, I think you'll probably find it on the Not For Everyone YouTube though, so you won't have to go far. Anyway, toodaloo, my babies. Thanks for listening. Love ya. Kisses. Who gets to decide what's creatin? What?